Calvin has been talking about these paradigms for the Christian community, from Paul, the pilgrim paradigm, and then the cross paradigm with the anti-hero motif. So, I don't know if you have something. Let's get going.
Hey, brother, can you paradigm?
Can you paradigm, brother?
No.
Explain what a paradigm means, will you, please?
So,
as we go home.
I have a question.
Okay.
It isn't necessarily Pauline.
That's good. I won't have to.
In reading Walt's volume on Good News for the Poor and other parallel kinds of writings, it would seem that from the point of view of the Gospels, especially Luke, God has a bias towards the poor, the weak, the vulnerable. If that is a biblical hermeneutic, how do we translate that into a hermeneutic for ministry in the church? What are we seeing if we talk that kind of language in the church? Are we really wanting to say that God favors, as we might pit one group against another? Are we saying that God has a more special place in his heart for those? Is that something different? How do we say that we are all created equal and are equally loved by God, at the same time say that God has a bias towards the poor and the weak?
Good question. What do some of you do with that? It must be something you face regularly in your parish. What do you do, Lynn, with that? You know, I've faced it.
Well, I keep the two things in tension and balance. He just kept saying that this is so, and also said that, you know, God loves all people equally. So don't we just keep the two in tension and balance in relationship to people who are people of wealth or affluence, relating to them with the gospel? Do we make a distinction?
I think we spiritualize by saying that the rich are poor in other ways, you know. And I'm not sure that's valid. Using the text.
That's what Matthew does. Blessed are the poor in spirit, so you get around the problem. Isn't that right?
Amen.
Yes. That's a toughie. What do some of you do? That'd be interesting to share that.
Kierkegaard called that into question when he said, is it the same when Jesus says, go sell all that you have and give it to the poor, and when the priest says, go sell all that you have and give it to me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that just there's a way, though, isn't there, to get around that? I mean, Lynn's not suggesting that necessarily that the institution should profit from that proclamation, are you? You're just saying, how can you really take that seriously in a congregation which you have mostly middle class, some upper middle class people?
How do you do without laying a guilt trip? I think you compromise. I tend to bail out of that issue because I don't know how to deal with it. I know that by spiritualizing the idea of being poor, you may not be faithful to a text that you're preaching, especially this from Luke. And I can't preach Matthew's Beatitudes without thinking about what Luke says. I don't know.
Is that a corrective, though, of the idea that, since we have some new, the Jews had that riches were a sign of favor of God? And I think we even maybe have that idea, don't we? I've been blessed. Or if I have lots of this world's good, then really, you know, God is there must be something in me, or God is good, and I must be good, and the sign of that is the fact that he's blessed me. And so these poor people over here that don't have anything, it's because they must have done something wrong, or in some way they don't love God, therefore God, they cannot be blessed.
Poor because they deserve to be poor. Yeah, that's the much abused Protestant ethic. But we all know that where the holes are in that, don't we? Actually, the holes were made in that view before the modern era. Actually, in the first century, the Qumraners called themselves the poor thing of the many, and also pure thing of the many, both. But that term there is I think taken to refer to those who are preparing for the arrival of the kingdom. It's a theological term, not just a socioeconomic term for the Qumraners. And I think it is in Paul, when Paul talks about taking the offering to the poor among the saints in Jerusalem. He's not just talking, there no doubt are those there who in the congregation have great economic need, but it's primarily a theological term for Paul, I think, referring to those who have a certain form of piety. And in that sense, I think Matthew and Paul would probably be somewhere pretty close together. The Jerusalem offering, some people want to argue, is taken because Paul knows of the famine and he wants to alleviate that condition. But it's probably more likely a theological symbol, the fact that the Gentiles are now coming up to the holy city and bringing their gifts representing the arrival of the kingdom. So it's theologically and eschatologically a powerful symbol for Paul. But I think in terms of Paul's own preaching, at least in the Corinthian congregation, he says that, as he describes the congregation, most of those folks were what you would call people on the kind of outer edges of the society. Not many of you were rich, not many of you were powerful, not many of you were well born, but God took that which is weak and despised in the world, shame wise. So that reflects something of the constituency of that congregation, I think. But, it's just the kind of, the question you pose, I think, is just kind of classical struggle that we face in the parish, that I face too. How do you use the resources in a responsible way that you have? And how do you, can you get by with just, you can do something with benevolence budgets. That's not direct, and you can do something in special cases, like the church can stand with those in great need. There were not a great surplus of churches, for example, to resettle the boat people. That may sound a little Boy Scoutish, but I really don't think it is. The needs in the third world. Surely there are some ways we can tie into those issues. But that's really tough, and I think it has to be worked out. I don't mean for this to be a cop-out, but in your own situation. That's the reason I was interested in hearing what some of you do. What do some of the rest of you do with that kind of issue, which is, I think, a kind of fundamental one?
I'm always curious what the people who write the books decide to do personally. I don't want to lay that on Mr. Pilgrim, I always want to know, gee whiz, they've written all this stuff, and now what have they taken some steps personally? Pilgrimage.
Is the snack bar still
And I think that's the only way it can go, is if we share with each other some very small steps that have been significant to us about the use of our resources.
I don't want to jump in too much in the conversation.
but
I do want to just respond a trifle. Because I think it's a fair question, even for those who write books. I can cop out and say I'm just laying out what Luke says, and then it's up for all of us to work on it. And in a way, it's not even a total cop-out. I think maybe that's maybe legitimate. The task of the biblical interpreter is to be as honest as possible with the intent of the biblical writer, and then we all have to lift that up, and then we all have to wrestle with it. And I've worked on this for some time and taught it a lot at adult classes and so forth. The one thing I always begin by saying, I'm in this struggle with you. I think I hear what Luke is saying, and I'll try to share that with you. The response to that call, I'm struggling with you, and I think it has to be there. And so don't judge my book on how well I'm doing. But you can't back off. I mean, can't totally go that way either. I will assure you there have been many hot discussions in our family on what the implications of that are. We've had far more concern for global justice, and it's translated into some small steps. But the whole, I don't know, just sort of revival of awareness of the question has been a result. There's a fine book, maybe it must be in the library here, I'm not sure, but it's called Living More Simply. Is that, did any of you see it in the bookstore here? I don't know if it is, but it's a collection of stories, of real life stories of people who are trying to take seriously what the call of discipleship means with respect to the way we use our possessions. And there's stories of some radical steps, but mainly very small steps, but trying to take seriously at least the fact that you can't cop out finally by saying God loves rich and poor alike, hence it doesn't matter what I do with my possessions. You just can't go that direction. There is a call to the rich, you know, and it's got to be responded to, and we're part of those rich. What that ultimately means that, you know, we don't finally earn our salvation by our response, but nevertheless, God's call is involved, and our response is a part of God's call, and we can't avoid it. You can come back again.
I have two things that go through my mind in this relationship. One of them is I found Walter Brueggemann a great help to me as I struggled with this. While he was with us, what was it, 4 years
ago?
And the whole idea of landedness. And, it's hard to be a person of gratitude and benevolence when you own the bakery. The other thing is, Taylor's book, Enough is Enough, is another one that really calls us to the thing you're pointing to. To really struggle with the question of, you know, where do we set our limits? Where do we set our limits? Mm-hmm. And the other thought that went through my mind is, I think we have to be careful that we don't take out these verses about God loving the poor and assume that's all there is. That's the total story of the scriptures. That's not all there is to God's outlook on the totality of his creation.
I'd like to challenge Calvin a little bit more. I think you're pretty easy on your response on Paul's attitude toward possessions. Because if you go fully in the direction you were moving there, just sort of reinterpreting the offering in the as a theological symbol, which I agree it was, as a symbol of unity of the church. Nevertheless, there was a real gift being brought there for a real need. And it seems to me you held up this morning beautifully for us that anti-hero motif and the fact that the essence of what it means to be a Christian is to be involved in what the cross means in Christian life.
Yeah.
And Paul himself being the model, it seems to me, of one who could live pretty close to a St. Francis that we hear about tonight.
And then when he says, imitate me, I thought you were pointing in that direction. Uh-huh. I'd like to hear you a little more.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I suppose you could say that Paul goes in that direction, but the problem with that, Walt, is why does he want to take the offering to Jerusalem? See, there are poor people all over the place. Surely as many poor people in Asia Minor or more than there are in Jerusalem. And there's a special reason that offering is going to Jerusalem. And I think Paul is taking the offering to Jerusalem primarily because he's taking Isaiah seriously, who talks about in the end time the Gentiles coming up to Jerusalem with gifts.
Well, we're talking about the poor.
Blessed are those who hunger after righteousness. I wish we had some extra cones I'd like to offer you.
60 different bites.
You just lost your credibility.
This is called the common cone. This is obscene.
I had one of those this afternoon.
Did you recover okay? Well,
they can't see you.
What happened in the early church when Barnabas decided of his own volition, evidently not directly of the Lord's command, to give everything that he had, to turn it into the apostles sort of as a common source of livelihood? And then, of course, Ananias and Sapphira abusing that. Do you know anything speaking in terms of history, how that faded out? I can't see much of it in the book of Acts from that point on. Did it die right then and there? Is there any other historian, secular historian, perhaps, who says something to that?
Yeah. I'm going to have a crisis on my hands in a moment. I'm laughing not because the question is a very good question.
I had a lady in our church who said that she really felt guilty in sitting in overstuffed furniture. She really felt, literally, that she should. I don't say she did it that way. She didn't give up all that she had, but she felt that was what Christ really would want her to do. That she should sit, she could sit on an apple box and get along that way, live to that kind of a rugged lifestyle. I have men in the church, a few that are businessmen, who get very perturbed at me if I preach along the line of what we've been talking about tonight.
Yeah.
And throwing passages at me like it is not money, it's the love of money. And who would there be to give generous gifts to promote the Lord's work if people did not work, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, or did not make a livelihood that was would enable them to give generously, so that it's your stewardship and not just being poor, but how you use that as a good steward of that which God has given you. These are arguments that I, as a pastor, have heard for many, many years and have wrestled with.
Well, and that's the kind of thing that Niebuhr talked about, kind of ambivalence you feel, but also the recognition that you have within your hand power, which is what money is, and then the injunction to use it in a responsible way, knowing that there's no perfect answer, but any answer that you, if you give away all your money or give it all up, then you, in a sense, that in a sense could be a cop-out, an unwillingness to responsibly use the resources which are there. So it seems to me you're exactly right. With regard to the communal,
Neil Coleman.
communal issue. It's do you know more about Acts than I do? I don't know very much about Acts. Oh, great. Thank you.
There we are. Thank you.
We have plates here. Would anyone like some? What do you think happens in the Lutheran situation?
Yeah, I don't like the argument that I hear that this was a noble experiment that failed. I think that's typical of most commentaries as they look at that. I don't think you can say that. We just don't have enough information in the rest of Acts to really know. You don't get any more summaries of what the early church was like, even in the book of Acts. And it's only in those first three summaries in the chapters that you really get that kind of description. So I think it's a little dangerous to say it just didn't succeed, and that's why we don't hear about it further. My argument, when I looked at that as carefully as I could, was that whatever happened to it, Luke held up the model of that early church that shared radically of its possessions with one another. He held that up as the model for what the community that's living in the Spirit of God ought to be like. I don't think he was concerned about what happened to it. He held it up as a model. It's a model in which the community coming in it together, not to have any poor among them. And we're concerned then about making sure that really took place in that community. So it's consistent with the call to radical sharing of our possessions that we find in the gospel. So I like to shift the argument away from saying, this is an experiment that failed. I like to say, I think Luke holds it up as a model for the kind of sharing that ought to take place.
Oh, you think Luke really did idealize that?
Definitely, yes.
A little bit like the Qumraners did. You give up everything, it belongs.
Well, see, I don't quite interpret that as giving up everything. Okay. I think it's... I think that's putting too much into that passage. Nevertheless, it was that as the needs were there, they were willing to share possessions and everything they had. Barnabas is the good example, and Ananias and Sapphira are the bad example.
Well, do you think then that if we took Luke seriously, we'd be a little more open to alternative patterns within the church and in families, as far as that goes? Communal living, so forth.
That would be one possibility. I don't think that's the only one.
Mm-hmm.
But I would think wherever there are Christian communities, that means you're caring for one another. That means, it means I have to sell something rather significant, I do it. But that's mm-hmm. where the need lies. Now, I know where the difficulty comes, of course, is, you've got one community that's not the same as another community, and, we got to have an interweaving of communities, the interconnectedness of communities. And then there's the world out there. what do you do out with the world outside the Christian community? I just see it as an attempt for Luke to say the Christian community is a sharing community. There's no way you can avoid that. That's what the Spirit of Christ really wants to shape into.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any sense in which we do that through government in terms of whatever kinds of social welfare programs that we do? Can you do that? Have we informed the body politic that now we begin to feel some responsibility, the community feels some responsibility toward those that are on the poor?
Well, let me skew your question just a little. And please. Let me back off and come at it in a slightly different way. I don't know, are you familiar with E.R. Dodds and his little book, Pagan and Christian in an Age of Anxiety? It's actually about the post-apostolic era and the success of the church in a basically hostile world. And Dodd argues in that little book, which I think is a marvelous little book, and he himself is a religious skeptic, which makes it even more interesting in some ways. He argues that the church, he thought, succeeded because the desperate hunger for people in that era was not so much probably for meaning in life as for community, a sense of belonging. And he pointed out that and I think this is correct, that the church provided a circle in which people could feel that they belonged. And that also it took on certain tasks which were not provided by the state. For example, he points out that the church, that early church, regularly bought burial spots for the poor, who otherwise would have not had a spot where they could be buried, if their bodies would have been thrown out on the garbage heap. And so it's not just providing the basic need, but sort of getting at what George is talking about tonight, providing a caring community in which people could feel embraced and supported and encouraged, loved, forgiven. And if they got in kind of desperate shape, they knew that community was going to come to their support and aid. Now that's what he argues. And this is quite a challenge to the church today. I mean, how many of us, if we really got in serious financial difficulty, would go to the church? You know, that's kind of a tough question. Maybe some would, and maybe there are churches which would help. But I wouldn't, I guess I probably wouldn't be 100% confident that I'd get help. I mean, I at a kind of basic human level. Why don't you respond to that? What do you think?
We've had a couple of situations where our people responded. One was a family in the church who was going to lose their home because they were about a year behind in their mortgage payments. And the church member came to me to see if there was some way we could help, and we came up with $1,500 added on to what they were able to raise, and it saved their home.
Well,
in these times.
Great.
And recently there was another, it was more of a nursing home situation, you know. You have insurance for hospitalization, but not for nursing home. And we were able to come up with some bottom-month help that in this case did the trick. Mm. It was very minimal, but it helped in this situation.
Okay. I don't want us to get off of this topic, but if there are other concerns, people like to.
Dr. Retzel?
Yeah, you're kind of, it's really, yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to ask a question about Paul's view of women,
mm-hmm.
and how you would respond to some of the things that Dr. or Pastor Harvey said, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any other, any other dimensions to that that we should be aware of?
Yeah, well, she's largely, as I understand her, she's here so she can correct me, largely been talking about interpretations or hermeneutical applications of the text in later situations. And I totally agree with what she said, that those texts have been severely abused and misused. Now, I feel a little more comfortable about saying, but I should say that it seems to me the task, or one of the antidotes to that, those misapplications, which is what I'd call them, is careful exegetical work about the meaning of those texts. I can't quite see you. You see me okay, right?
I can see you. Fine.
Okay. The chocolate all my chin and everything. So, well, I guess, though, that what I would do if I were interpreting these texts in congregations, wherever I speak, I always do this, is make a very clear distinction between the Pauline and the Deutero-Pauline view of women. And Elaine Pagels, for example, has recently, or she's written actually several books, but has done a lot of work on Paul and women, and so has Robin Scruggs at Chicago Theological Seminary and elsewhere. And they all point out that in the Deuteropauline letters that we, and I would argue that Ephesians and Colossians, as well as 1st, 2nd Timothy and Titus, are Deuteropauline, that in those letters we have some slippage from the view that we have in Paul, in the undisputed letters. And that Paul's view is, for his own time, it seems to me, exceedingly liberating. If you look at chapter 7, 1 Corinthians, you'll see that everything he says about women, he applies equally to men. And now, the opening section of 1 Corinthians 7, it's better for a man not to touch a woman, is probably a slogan from the Corinthian correspondence. I can get into that if you want me to, but their whole series of slogans are quotes, which Paul is quoting from a Corinthian letter that he is using then to respond. He quotes them and then responds to them.
Right.
And even if that is written by Paul, that sounds pretty sexist. I think it's written in the context of his eschatological perception, which I briefly alluded to, and that is Paul's belief that the house is burning down, essentially. And that in the, and that he's fully Jewish in his affirmation of the wholesomeness and of sex and family life and so forth. I don't think Paul is an ascetic in the later sense of the word as it came to be experienced in Christianity, in monastic movements, but he's kind of provisionally ascetic. That is, he believes that in this period of emergency, that perfectly normal, wholesome domestic concerns are suspended in the face of the crisis. That is, the house on fire, you don't think about making love. So, oh, very good. I hope everybody heard
it. Nurse guards.
And then later on, chapter 7, he talks about the forms of this world passing away and that the eschatological hour is upon us and so forth. So all that whole discussion in chapter 7 is made in light of that view. And then there's one other point in chapter 7 that seems to me is quite important. And that is, Paul's talking, the Corinthians try and decide whether believers should divorce unbelievers or vice versa. He says the believer shouldn't divorce the unbeliever. And he said because the believer consecrates the marriage. Now, the term which he uses there, hagiazo, is a technical term which comes out of Paul's own Jewish background. And I actually heard David Dalba give a very long paper on this subject. He completely convinced me that this is the case, that when a proselyte would become a Jew and pass and be baptized and circumcised, male or received in the community as female, that that person was, after the initiation into the Jewish community, a new person. They were given a new name, like our giving baptized person's name, so forth. And so the Jews took that seriously and said, therefore, since they were new, then they had to reaffirm all the contracts that they had had before they became Jews. You see what I mean? Since you become new, all the old contracts and agreements have to be renegotiated. Now, that doesn't mean, according to the Jewish practice, that you go to the rabbi and say, well, I've just married this woman who has converted to Judaism, my wife has just converted to Judaism and she's a new person, or I've just converted to Judaism and I'm a new person, so we need to get remarried. But rather in a very practical way, what the Jews would say, that in consecrating the marriage, that is, in having sexual relations, one then mutually reaffirms the marriage. Now, interestingly enough, the Jewish community, only the male could do that. But Paul is saying in 1 Corinthians 7 that both the male and female can do it. That is, you can reconsecrate the marriage as a believer with the unbeliever. Now, it seems to me that's a dramatic statement about Paul's critical appraisal of his culture. Now, I think there are points at which he is not fully liberated. In 1 Corinthians 11, which Ms. Parvey referred to, there is one particular passage which it seems to me does imply subordination. But most of that passage deals with Paul's commentary on Genesis 2, actually, the creation narrative. Part of that discussion does not imply, it seems to me, subordinationism. When Paul, for example, says that the source of Christ is God, that the source of man is Christ, and that the source of woman is man, he's not, in that particular case, I'm convinced, implying that each is subordinate to the other. He uses the word kephale, head, and that's what it's translated in the RSV. The head of Christ is God, the head of man is Christ, the head of woman is man. But kephale there, I'm sure, as he's commenting on Genesis 2, refers instead to source and not to head in some sense of authority. See what I mean? In commenting on, Paul believes that Christ is pre-existent in the world, and though he comes from God, it's kind of a chronological thing, and that then God creates Adam, and that Adam becomes the source of woman, the rib business, you know. But I don't think it's subordinationism. I think it's often read as subordinationism, but don't think that particular passage is. Now, the only other comment that I would make would be with regard to the passage in 1 Corinthians 14, 32, 34, 35, where we have the statement that the woman should be silent in the church. And that passage, if you look at it carefully, you will, and this I don't think is a cop-out, I think it's pretty clear if you look at it carefully that it's an later insertion. Because it interrupts the drift of the passage. Clearly introduces a subject that's not even in that passage in 14. And also, if you look at it, it's almost a virtual word-by-word restatement of an exact same statement that's made in 1 Timothy. And which we know now is not Pauline. And I think that's agreed by almost everybody except Billy Graham. that statement also clearly contradicts what Paul has just said in 1 Corinthians 11 about the woman prophesying in church, which is for Paul an intellectual interpretive function. Prophecy for Paul is a rational exercise interpreting the tradition to relate to a later period. And so there's a real problem there. And the problem seems to me is resolved by the fact that P46, the earliest manuscript of the Pauline Corpus does not have that passage in it. And so what I think has happened is that the passage, the injunction for women to be silent in the church and earn their salvation by having children is in 1 Timothy. And Elaine Pagels thinks that, and I'm inclined to agree with her, that 1 Timothy has written that because of the mainline church response to Gnosticism, in which the woman and the man are equally participating in the service and have equal roles in the Gnostic community. And this response in 1 Timothy to Gnosticism sort of throws back to the old culture to repudiate Gnosticism by establishing the old hierarchy again. Well, somebody then later has seen, well, look, Paul says in 1 Timothy, woman should be silent in the church. We have this problem over here in Corinthians. So it's inserted there to try to balance what's going on in 11. So it seems to me that's what's going on there. But I'm convinced that 1 Corinthians 14, 32, 34 is not Pauline.
How do you date 1 Timothy?
1 Timothy? Probably end of the century or even a little later. And see, Paul's dead.
Read back.
Yeah, read back in the later. That happens, as you know, if you just look at New Testament stuff, it happens all the time. John 21, you have, and also in John, you have the story of the woman taking adultery, which is clearly later insertion. And the long ending in Mark, you know, which is printed in italics at the bottom of the page in most Bibles. That kind of thing happened. I think happened pretty regularly. Our idea of a set text is really is an idea that comes much later after the formation of the canon, and the texts were much more fluid and amenable to change before 200, I think. And that those changes, I think, to some extent, were necessitated by the struggle with Gnosticism. Yeah.
Along that same line, many of us, I'm sure, are familiar with Paul Jewett's work. And I think, wasn't it a Light-sponsored event just about a year ago or so? Many of us may have attended. And we spent an afternoon with him. We had him explain his work. And wasn't his book, God is Male and Female, was the main source for that?
Male and female in the New Testament, I think it's a problem in the Bible.
And I'm appreciating, frankly, much more what you're saying. And you're getting to the same place, I think, but how you're getting there, then I think I did in how he got there. Now, are you familiar with work, and maybe can you pass judgment on him a little bit?
I'm not familiar with Paul Jewett's work, and so if you could fill me in.
Well, Paul Jewett is willing to let that 1 Corinthians 14 text stay in there. I mean, he doesn't use that argument to get out. But he points out to the breakthrough passages that he would call them, such as Galatians 3, mm-hmm. 26 and 27. That is the hermeneutic that you use when you want to look at Paul's attitude toward women. Even though in practice Paul didn't carry through on it, nevertheless, Galatians 3, 26 and 1 Corinthians 7, I think, both show a mutuality that is there in the new community, and that redemption is the motif now, when subordination now is no longer a part of it. Relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I don't know that we disagree so much, except that it seems to me that doesn't satisfy the contradiction you have. You take that passage in 14 as an authentic Pauline statement. You clearly got a contradiction there with 1 Corinthians 11, it seems to me. But if I might just say a word about this passage in Galatians and then Corinthians. The Corinthian situation, I don't want to go beyond. Okay. I don't want to. The Corinthian situation is I think, requires the discussion that Paul gives it. He says more about the male-female issue there than anywhere else, as you know. Because I think there are Gnostic tendencies which are developing within the Corinthian congregation. I think the whole issue of head covering, length of hair, all of that issue in 1 Corinthians 11 is there because the Corinthians essentially have picked up on a primitive gospel tradition that in the kingdom of God there's no distinction between male and female. That maleness and femaleness are obliterated. There's the long history behind that that I could get into if you'd like for me to some other time. So what Paul's trying to do is reassert not subordination but distinction between the two. And so it's very interesting that when he, I think Galatians is before 1 Corinthians, but the whole dating question is not crucial here. That slogan, in Christ there's neither Jew nor Greek, bond or free, male nor female, appears in 1 Corinthians without the last ingredient. In Christ there's neither Jew nor Greek, bond nor free, period. Now why does he not say, as he says in Galatians, male nor female? I think he doesn't say that because he thinks he'll be misunderstood. Because that's precisely the problem. From their point of view, they want no distinctions. The man, there's a lot of evidence in that book to support that. The man sleeping with his mother-in-law, for example. Evidently both believers. Or sleeping in the same house. I'm not sure they're sleeping with each other. So I don't know that really, if I were more familiar with this work, I could respond perhaps better. Maybe we'll take one more question.
What does the whole anti-hero thing you were talking about today have to do with American life today and football heroes and, and children's models for heroes?
I think that's really crucial.
So what do we do?
Yeah, that's the hermeneutical test, which is much more difficult than the exegetical test. Measurably more difficult. What do you think we should do? Just being sensitive to the problem helps, doesn't it? To start saying, these are images out there that are making an impact. Let me give you an example. This BMX bicycle racing is a $2 billion industry now in this country. In E.T., we have the escape being made on BMX bicycles, which is made by a Japanese company, which immediately after the movie introduces the version E.T. And you go to one of those races and you see these little kids walking around and they're just walking billboards for the so-called professionals in BMX bicycle racing. They're wearing the same kind of chaps they wear, they've got elbow pads with somebody's name on it, and so forth. So they're just pouring themselves right into that mold. And at least being sensitive to the fact that this is being done. And I think that's a really important first step, to just sort of open our eyes and take a good look at the culture and see where the models are, what they're doing to us and for us. The Sears people were not dumb when they had this blue jean that wasn't moving and they hired Cheryl Teagues to buy it. And then that jean just took off and they sold, their sales just skyrocketed actually. So those are the kinds of things that we can be more sensitive to, and I think being sensitive to them at least then gets us to the point where we can talk about them with each other, with our kids, and help them be, and ourselves, more sensitive to them. And I'm sure you have other ideas about how this can be done, but it's a classical, perennial problem.
But the very fact that there are other alternatives, that there are alternative modes or models that could be lifted up. Sister Teresa, or Mother Teresa, or somebody else. I don't know.
I think these models are in the church. I don't think they're all outside of the church.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I agree. We're part of the culture.
In the lecture you gave this morning about the last American hero.
Yeah.
You know, some of those images are very powerful. The car.
Oh, absolutely.
The sort of the rebellion against the feds. All those are very powerful. And I'm kind of intimidated by those. I don't even know how to even begin saying, well, take a look at Christ. You know, it's almost a...
Yeah, well, I don't think that is where you begin. I think you begin by looking at your world, and those are powerful. Just recognizing that they're powerful seems to me a very important beginning. We can't do anything about them until we know what it is that we have to do something about. But my plea was that we just open our eyes and look, and rather than kind of supinely accepting.
But how do you explore the mystique of these symbols? See, that's where I keep struggling, and that's preaching question. You can hold them up, and we all sense they're pseudo, you know. They're false, they're idols, they're gods. But we're all attracted to these gods.
Oh, yeah.
How does that cross-image finally become the reality?
How did Paul do that with the apostles and daddy?
Well, you know, in 2 Corinthians, maybe he's not a very good model in the way he does it. What he says, I think, is really quite good. We don't really know how effective Paul was, you see. He used some techniques that I find kind of grating. He can be incredibly sarcastic.
And you don't want those Macedonians to shame you?
Yeah, and you know, 1 Corinthians 4 just drips with sarcasm. Look at that. Already you're rich, already you're full, already you rule. Oh, wish you did, you know, then you might help us, that kind of thing. And 2 Corinthians 10 through 15 is one of the sharpest pieces in all of his letters. And we just don't know how. But it's his perception that I'm after, and so. But I think that's a good question that we just have to sort of take with us and wrestle. Now that's not with, but even if you had groups within the church, or a group that could be formed to even begin to look and think about these kinds of questions, seems to me that'd be a beginning. Other people who can develop your own response, and I don't know, you can't predict what that would be. Right?
But what bothers me so much is the mixing of the symbols, the attempt to put Christianity on some of these power symbols, and these success symbols, where you know there's a veneer of the cross, but you know what the real power symbol is, success or something like that.
Oh yeah.
The athletic movement, where there doesn't be any conscience at all, even among the Christians, professional athlete, about the amazing affluence that they have. No perception at all of that.
And they're sincere believers.
They're Christian, and they won't violate their contract. Well, why should they violate their contract? But the whole fact that they're living a lifestyle, it's so out of proportion.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't even seem to come close. I find it impossible to bet.
Yeah. Well, I think.
And why we pay tickets to go to football games?
That's true.
Now we can hardly call Jim Zorn an anti-hero at this point.
Well, see, that's that mix of symbols that destroys the Christian cause, really.
Yeah. Well, those kinds of perceptions, I think, are really, really helpful. Yeah. Well,
we got to stop.
Let's leave with questions, okay?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.